The Big Story is brought to you by Scotiabank. This is not another podcast episode about a bad climate change report. Of course, every week there's one of those, and this week's was the worst in a long time.
Scientists with the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change
issued a report saying if drastic action is not taken, climate change can reach crisis levels in a decade.
Even a rise of 1.5 degrees would be disastrous.
But this is a podcast episode about people. People who believe in climate change, people who deny climate change, and mostly about the people who are already living in a version of those bleak futures the reports paint. It's one thing to recite the numbers. Everyone does it. And it's another to look at places in the world that are coping with these results right now. In Asia, in Africa, and yes, in Canada. And if stories like that can't open our eyes both to the reality of the situation, but also to the potential solutions that do exist, then what can? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Bob Henson is a meteorologist and climate writer for The Weather Company. He's also the author of The Thinking Person's Guide to Climate Change. And this year he worked on a series called Exodus, about people who have had their lives uprooted by the changing climate. So first of all, tell me, what is climate migration?
So weather and climate always affects how people live and where they live. That's been the case throughout human history. When we talk about climate migration these days, it's typically referring to the effects of climate change. So a place that perhaps supported a certain kind of agriculture doesn't support that anymore, or a place where you once could work by the edge of the water is experiencing sea level rise, so you have to pull up roots, or that sort of thing. So these changes are not necessarily all related to the human-produced gases we're putting into the atmosphere. Sometimes there's local effects related to land use that intertwine with the behavior of weather and climate. But nevertheless, it all ends up being that a change in the way we experience the weather and climate means we have to move somewhere else. So that's kind of how I see the phrase, and I think how it's being used and how we're kind of approaching the topic in this series called Exodus.
We primarily wanted to talk to you because of that series and obviously because of the report this week. I feel like when we see reports that come out about climate change, the news is always bad and it's always somewhat academic, but you guys are kind of trying to put a human face on it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I feel the same way about climate change coverage. I think too often it becomes, you know, the end of the world. And we tend to think of it in black or white terms as we do so many other issues, like we're going from life as usual to apocalypse. And in fact, there's plenty of gray areas in the whole process. And but it is really affecting people, and that's the focus of this whole package. It's happening now and projected to happen in the future. And it's both a large-scale thing and a very human individual thing. You know, these boil down to individual decisions. Do you stay or do you leave? And if you leave, where do you go? And how do you create a new life for yourself? And I think that really does put a human face on this massive and often abstract kind of issue.
As someone who's been studying this and writing about this for some time, what was your initial reaction to the report this week?
Well, you know, I've been covering climate change since around 1990. I started my career at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research, and that was just after 1988 when the topic kind of blew open and the International or Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was established in 1989-1990. The first report came out. So I've been kind of in this from the beginning of it becoming really a household topic, and it's been difficult at times to see the lack of progress. I mean, we've had greater and greater understanding. It's just been really difficult to get traction on reducing emissions in particular. This week's report kind of put an accent mark on that, I think.
What did you think of the reaction to it?
I was heartened to see that it got the attention that I think it deserves. You know, the 1.5C goal kind of erupted in the Copenhagen meeting in particular that I was at in 2009. The 2-degree goal had been around for quite a while. It was developed within the European Union a couple decades ago. And in a sense, it was kind of an artificial target. It was like, well, let's think of 2 degrees C and look at what will happen at that level and what will happen at 3 or 4 or just at 1. And 2 seemed like a good point where the impacts become increasingly more serious. A lot of island states at Copenhagen made the case that, well, that's all well and good that you all can consider 2 degrees this threshold, but for us it's more like 1.5, and there was science to support that. So as a result, the UN decided to take this 1.5C guideline more seriously.
So let's talk about Exodus. Your contribution to that was a look at Churchill, Manitoba. What's happening there?
You know, I was intrigued by Manitoba for some time. When I wrote my book, The Thinking Person's Guide to Climate Change, which originally was The Rough Guide to Climate Change, the port of Churchill and the rail line leading from southern Manitoba to the port had just been sold to this company called Omnitrax in Denver, and they had actually acquired the port for $1 as part of the deal. Essentially, for buying the rail line, they got the port thrown in. And to me, that was a sign of a company looking ahead and seeing the value of having this port on, you know, on Hudson Bay, and looking ahead to, you know, longer ice-free seasons and perhaps that port becoming prosperous. And so I was sort of following that evolution for some time. Well, it turned out there was this sequence of really awful coincidental but compounding events that happened. And first of all, the wheat production was nationalized to some extent in Canada in the early 2010s. You may know more about this than I do, but ultimately what it meant is that wheat was not getting shipped through Churchill anymore in the way it had been for decades. So a lot of what had kept that port and the rail line going economically just went away in the early 2010s. So the port was more or less shut down to commercial traffic. That was one blow. Then the rail line was hit in early 2017 by flooding that resulted from massive snows in March and I think another one in April. And so as a result, there was washouts along the rail line between Gillam and Churchill, and it wasn't fixed. The company just did not fix the rail line. They maintained it was not economically feasible to do so. So the town of Churchill all of a sudden is left without a working port and without a rail line, so essentially cut off from the world. And they went all through the winter of 2017-18 in that state and went into this summer in that state. And that's when I spoke to people. And the sense of panic and dread and just uncertainty was really palpable. You could just hear it in people's voices. And, you know, what are we going to do? You know, it costs, you know, five times what it did a year ago just to live.
What kind of stuff happens in a community like that when the access for whatever reason vanishes?
Well, you can still get stuff. It's still possible to, you know, to buy food. It's just so costly, and so people have to make these terrible triage-like decisions. And, you know, they find ways to get by. You know, we're all infinitely adaptable, it seems, or almost infinitely, but it takes a toll on people. And, you know, some folks decided to move. It was kind of hard to get firm numbers, but it looks like the population might have gone down by a few dozen, even maybe as much as 100 people, and that's in a town of only about 900. So I think most people there probably knew at least one person who left.
What does it do to people when you're constantly wondering if you're going to stay or if you're going to go?
That's a good question. And, you know, I hadn't thought about the short-term versus long-term migration question, but now that you've raised it, it's interesting to contemplate, because in a fire or a flood setup, you're leaving and in short order, and you may never even have a place to come back to. So you're typically, you know, operating in a really tight time frame. But in the situation of climate migration, you have some time to contemplate the decision, but there maybe is even more of a finality to it, because you're sensing that in the long run, well, you know, whatever you've been doing to live in this place won't be tenable anymore. You know, it must be difficult, because you're navigating this decision not just for yourself, but you're considering all the people that you love and care about, and some of them may not be making the same decisions you are. Whereas in a fire or flood, everybody is pretty much getting out.
Up next.
Sometimes I do get frustrated when folks simply discount climate change completely, like that can't be true. I think sometimes people are simply trying to respond to what they're seeing.
You can save like never before with the Scotiabank Momentum Plus savings account. And right now, for a limited time, you can earn up to 3% interest until March 10th. You can find all the terms and conditions at scotiabank.com/MP. When you talk to people in Churchill or in other places that are really affected right now by climate change, are their attitudes towards climate change different? Do they believe it more? Do they take it more seriously?
You know, I don't know that that's the case necessarily. I think some folks do. The folks I talked to in Churchill tended to be kind of on the fence a little bit. You know, some folks were like, well, you know, maybe it's changing, maybe it's not, but, you know, we have to deal with the situation we find ourselves in right now.
Does that frustrate you?
I don't know, not necessarily. I think people deal with what they're having to deal with on the ground. Sometimes I do get frustrated when folks simply discount climate change completely, like that can't be true. I think sometimes people are simply trying to respond to what they're seeing. And, you know, a sea level rise of several inches isn't something you will look at and immediately snap your fingers and say, aha, I see it, you know. There's also lots of variability in things like crop, you know, good crops and bad crops, good years and bad years. So it can take time for that kind of understanding to build. And folks often will attribute things like this to just natural cycles, I think, because we know there are natural cycles. So it can be really hard in our minds to separate out a natural cycle from long-term change.
After reading the report that came out this week and knowing everything you know, what do you think the world and maybe North America in particular looks like in 2030?
Well, I think the report captured a lot of the points really nicely. You know, we're going to see heavier rains, maybe heavier snows in some places. When it rains or snows hard, it's going to rain or snow harder. I worry a lot about this trend toward hot droughts in places like California and even British Columbia, where when it gets dry, it's not just dry, it's also hot and dry. And that's a really distinct trend in recent decades. So those are things that pop up right away. You know, sea level rise will continue, but I think it'll be manifested most and noticed most with what we kind of laughingly call nuisance flooding. I have places like Miami Beach where they get flooding maybe in some neighborhoods 4 or 5 times a year, and by 2030 that might be 10 or 20 times a year or 30 depending on where you are. So those changes are going to evolve. People will start to think more about where they live and move different places based on that. So all those things come to mind, you know, more heat waves. But in other places, you know, life will not look hugely different. And that's one of the great challenges in dealing with climate change is it doesn't affect everyone equally. And it doesn't feel like a crisis in every particular spot of the globe. But in others, it absolutely will be like a crisis. So that makes it such a challenging topic to grapple with. But the global nature of it and the causes and consequences are so massive that we can't look the other way. We have to deal with it.
If you were to sort of look at following up Exodus, you know, maybe a year or two down the road, where would you be looking for the next big climate migration to happen?
Boy, you know, I racked my brain trying to think of places around the globe where we're going to be seeing climate migrations in preparing for this package. One area that we might see more of in the next, say, 5 or 10 years, I would think, is places like the wildland-urban interface in western U.S., western Canada, where folks have bought property in beautiful areas, you know, just outside, you know, cities, small cities and towns, adjoining beautiful forests. Okay, those are wonderful places, but they're very, very vulnerable to wildfire. And, you know, I wonder in some cases whether folks will just decide, well, it's not worth the risk anymore. Even if their house hasn't burned down, maybe they've had to evacuate several times.
As someone who has to communicate to people how serious this is, how do you balance that with not wanting to sort of turn them off completely? Because a lot of people are getting kind of fatalistic about this, right? Like, it's already happened. We're passing the tipping point. There's not much we can do. How do you balance kind of trying to get them to take it seriously with not just giving up?
You know, I sense that fatalism and I hear it from people, and it frustrates me a lot because I think this is a problem we can't afford to just shrug our shoulders at. I do think that we need to keep in mind that, like everything else, it is a spectrum. It's not a light switch. It's not on or off. It's a process that will be less bad or more bad in many places, depending on how much carbon emissions go in the air. So, and we have control over that. We have a say in that. And every individual has a say in their own carbon footprint. And collectively, we have a say in what, you know, cities, states, nations, and the world do. So there is always something that can be done. It's not going to have an immediate satisfying effect necessarily, you know, but if you insulate your house, your utility bills will go down, and that's certainly a good immediate benefit you'll notice. If we reduce the amount of fossil fuel burning and the amount of pollution that's emitted that way, there will be health benefits as well as climate change reductions. So there's always things to do and always progress to be made. And I'm personally, I would call myself a worried optimist, and that hasn't changed. But, you know, reports like this certainly emphasize that we can't just delay forever, you know, taking this really seriously. It would take a Herculean effort to cut global emissions in half, as the report recommended, within the next decade or two or three. But it, as the report emphasized, it's not literally impossible. It really is a matter of political and public will.
So what happens next in Churchill? Do we have a sense of what the future holds for them?
Well, there is some really good news in Churchill. Rail line was bought by a consortium involving a couple of Canadian companies as well as First Nations and other northern communities in that area. So there, things have moved pretty quickly, actually, in the last month or so. And the rail line has been actually repaired as of early October. So the question is, will the line actually be able to be opened before winter, or will it take until next spring to get it rolling? And so residents are still kind of on edge, wondering if they're going to have to go through another winter without that rail connection that they so need. But in the long term, this is certainly great news. It's going to have a strong local component of management, and that's something people in the area told me they were really craving, because there's people there that used to work on the rail line, Indigenous folks who maintain that rail line for decades and decades and just know the landscape and the way the rail line behaves and buckles and acts during different types of weather. So I think they're really happy that there will be a local say in how the line is managed. You know, we'll have to see what happens in terms of whether the economy recovers to where it was before, or whether it even does better or worse or whatnot locally. But I think people there are certainly feeling more upbeat.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks so much, Jordan. Great to be here.
Bob Henson, meteorologist, climate writer for The Weather Company, literally wrote the book on climate change. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotiabank. You can earn up to 3% interest until March 10th with the Scotiabank Momentum Plus Savings Account. Conditions apply. For more from us, visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. And next week, pay attention, tune in, pot becomes legal, and we are on it all week with a cast of characters from across Canada. What does it look like on the ground? What do you have to know if you're a parent? How can you make money off of it? What happens to the black market? There are a million things we don't know about what Canada's going to look like after October 17th. We're going to try to answer those questions for you next week. So tune in, subscribe. Tell your friends. We're on Apple, we're on Google, we're on Stitcher, we're on wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on social media at Big Story Podcast on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Claire Broussard is our lead producer. Megan Coley is our associate editor. And Ryan Clark is our associate producer. That's it for us. We'll be back Monday.